Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's cool fact of the day is that the ancient Egyptians used dried crocodile dung as a contraceptive. They made something called a pessary, and a pessary is the earliest contraceptive device for women ever known, at least that we know about. And pessaries are objects or mixtures of stuff that you put in the vagina to keep sperm from swimming up where it shouldn't go. And the Egyptians did this starting as early as 1850 BC. It was crocodile dung, honey, and sodium carbonate, which is actually kind of gross.
But how many infections did that lead to?
They don't really know from the fossil or archaeological records, but right. I suspect not that many, because there's that whole gut biome thing. Another fact that's totally unknown is that in the Middle East, when people would get dysentery, British soldiers asked the locals, what do you do? And they said, you follow a camel around and you eat fresh camel poop and it'll fix the dysentery. And to this day, that still works, but I haven't tried it. I just hear it's good.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Incredible.
Now, we've grossed everyone out, and we've already started talking, but I haven't introduced you. Let me introduce you. This is none other than 7-time New York Times bestseller Neil Strauss. Neil is very well known for Emergency, for The Game, and for his new book, which is really good, called The Truth, an uncomfortable book about relationships. Neil, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I've listened to it so much, so I'm happy to be here.
Wow. And as a listener, that's even cooler. Now, your other book, Rules of the Game, I didn't mention, but I mean, 7 books. I don't think I've read all 7, but the first time I became familiar with your work was actually Emergency.
Great.
Which goes way back, which was, and so, by the way, if you're going to get a book from Neil Strauss, you should buy The Truth, because it's a profound book, and it's maybe the antithesis of Emergency. Was that your first New York Times bestseller?
No, first one was way back. I did a book with Marilyn Manson called The Long, Hard Road Out of Hell. That was like just a crazy, intense rock bio.
So you inspired me. I don't think in the times we've met I've ever mentioned this, but I went and I did the Urban Escape and Evasion course, this one where they kidnap you and teach you to like break out of handcuffs and all this stuff.
Pick locks and hotwire cars.
Yeah. And in fact, in the class with me was a girl you were dating at the time.
Who was that?
I don't remember. This was like 6 years ago or something.
No way.
She was really hot. Uh-huh. And there was a Playboy Bunny in the class too. Uh-huh. Like, I was like, I've been locked in the same trunk as the Playboy Bunny. Like my life is complete. This was the coolest thing though. And your whole experience there was like this set of experiments were like, okay, I want to know what it's like to like kill and eat an animal. I want to know what it's like to push my limits. And you did all these crazy things. It's still like one of my favorite books.
He's actually coming to my house this weekend because I'm teaching a bunch of friends how to do all this stuff.
Oh, the lockpick kind of stuff?
Kevin Reed is coming to my home this weekend. It's actually, if you hadn't taken, I was going to invite you to come Friday and Saturday to do it. And
oh, wow.
It'll be some interesting people, too.
You know, I might be able to drop in. If we can
drop in. Maybe if you want to be on the second day, what they do is they, once you've learned all the skills, I'm really into practical applications. So as he does in the class, what they do is they handcuff you, tase you, waterboard you, give you some stress, drop you off somewhere, and you have to complete these missions while being hunted by bounty hunters. And so if you want to maybe be a bounty hunter on Sunday, you can search for the other students.
I'm going to be in Las Vegas. Darn. So, but if you're listening to this, we maybe just only got a little bit off track. But right. here's the deal. If you wanted to really push your limits, when I did this, like whenever it was 5-6 years ago, I thought I was reasonably calm. It pushed all my buttons. I was flipping out. Having bounty hunters chasing you, even though you know at one level, like, okay, they're not going to like really kill you. But if they catch you, they handcuff you and they drop you off in some part of town where you like have no phone, no resources, unless you hid something in a dumpster somewhere. Like it's really raw and like primal and visceral. And when I was done, I'm like, okay, I need to get better control of my nervous system because my fight or flight was like heavily activated.
Yeah, performing under stress is a whole new experience. If they put you under stress, all of a sudden, a lot of your skills go away.
Yeah. So this is one of those things where it's kind of a bucket list thing. And if you're sitting there in your cubicle going, oh my God, that's so cool, or you're driving right now, you might actually consider checking that out as one of those things like for a birthday gift or something. It takes 3 days, and when you're done, you'll be able to open doors you're not supposed to be able to open with lockpicks.
It's coming incredibly handy, the lockpicking and the set of jigglers to break into your own car, of course.
Of course. Right. I will admit that one time when I really had to pee in San Francisco, I picked a lock. Just in an office building because I didn't want to go to the front desk and get the key because it was two floors away. So you're like, okay, and you sort of sitting there. People are looking at you funny, but you still
I lost a file cabinet lock and it worked nicely. The funny thing is once you learn these skills, you never know where they're going to happen. I took an EMT course, which I'll say I highly recommend with some caveats. Mm-hmm. And the caveat, it's a great way to get a really quick kind of emergency medical education. The caveat is that they teach you how to do medicine emergency medicine doesn't get you sued, whereas a corpsman or a medic or someone who's on the battlefield does stuff that's better than an EMT isn't allowed to use. But it's a great quick emergency education.
You inspired me to look into that. The number of hours of EMT training was more than I could stomach, and still to this day. But I'm married to a doctor, so I'm like, I outsource
you're
that.
You're good. Yeah, exactly.
But I did buy some trauma kits at home.
Yeah, so like, and it's great. And then you're on the highway and someone wipes out of their motorcycle, you can stop. You can call a pair of paramedics and then deal with them while they're waiting. It happens surprisingly often in LA.
Well, one of the things that I find inspiring about the way you look at the world is exactly what you just said there. Like, you're talking about being prepared and having situational awareness and presence. And you have situational awareness when you walk into a bar. Like, you wrote about that pretty heavily in the game. Even though you've changed substantially since you wrote that book. But the same thing that they teach you in Urban Escape and Evasion or any of the explorations that you've written about are about, like, okay, what's going on out there and how do I have control over this? So let's talk about how having that maybe extra level of preparedness and awareness and saying, okay, if something happens, I know I've got it. Talk me through how you took that into basically your life as a pickup artist in the game and how you transformed from there into where you are now with your new book. Like, I want to, just from that perspective of like watching what's happening, that's what biohackers do.
Right. And I want to get back to the word control you mentioned, because I think it's interesting that you chose that word.
It was conscious.
Yes. I guess the way I've done my whole career and everything is that I've hit problems in life and then I start to solve them, and as the solution becomes really interesting or unique, I get to a level of maybe knowledge that I feel other people don't have or would find useful, I'll just say, you know what, maybe I should actually write a book about this, and I get to dedicate my whole entire life to doing it in the same way that you have, whereas you were doing this stuff for yourself and become more healthy, and then, like, oh, if I just build a business around this, I would have guessed, then I can actually, it kind of came, they come together, so now you get to do what you love, and it is your business, and you get to talk to interesting people and learn more, and it's still your what you're doing for work.
It is a pretty amazing change from working in computer security.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, like, have a conversation like this, even. Like, I would have this conversation with no recording just because I want to know what you're thinking, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's one of the goals of life, at least for me, is how can you organize your life around the stuff you love that you still do it, even if you didn't get paid.
Right. So you went on this an odyssey, really,
right?
When you, just for emergency, like that was multiple things, but at the same time, I think you were also like honing your game, so to speak, since your book is called The Game,
right?
But doing that, so you obviously did these things simultaneously, but you were picking topics of interest. So what made you decide to start like this really incredible arc of I want to be really good at the game of picking up women? And at the same time, you know, it ended this arc where you're like, okay, now I'm going to talk about the truth. So walk me through how having, like this is what, about a 15-year arc, would you say, 20 years?
It might be less. It might just be maybe 10 years or 10 years for this stuff. And I was writing for the New York Times and doing journalism for probably 10 years before that.
Okay, so you're writing for 10 years. And then about 10 years ago, you're like, all right, I'm going to try these things that are going to push my limits on pretty much all the limits you could find.
Yeah, I guess I was always doing it at the same time. I mean, that was the great thing about being a journalist is I'd be at the New York Times and I'd have to cover what I had to cover. But then I'd say, you know what? Comedy's fascinating to me. What if I went undercover as a stand-up comic for the New York Times and just tried to make it and from that perspective wrote about what it was like? But so I'd pitch them on that article. What I really wanted to do was get over my stage fright and social anxiety, and I figured that was a good way to do it. So I would just pitch them articles that would sort of improve my life. I wanted to learn snowboarding. I'd say, oh, why don't we do a weekend piece on learning to snowboard in Vermont?
Okay, you just made everyone listening want to be a journalist. Yeah. Because like, they're going to pay me to go have what I wanted to do.
No, it was incredible. Like, literally, I'd be like, okay, what country do I want to go to, and can I invent a plausible pretext to go here? Okay, I looked at the Fugees are going to Haiti to do their first concert there. Great. So not only do you get to go to Haiti, but you get to hang out with all the dictators there. You know, you're like, you're with the Fugees, so you're going to the president's palace, you're seeing Aristide, and you're going to, you know, in the ghettos, you're going everywhere, and then you're seeing the backstage at this concert where they're playing on stage and there are 10 guys with machine guns standing on stage. It's crazy. I guess I was always able to do that, but instead of, I guess, them being just articles, becoming books really allowed me to immerse further, to go deeper, and to get to the end of a thread of knowledge where you feel like you've gotten some degree of mastery versus being a dilettante as a journalist.
So you spend all this 10 years, now I'm kind of jealous, right? All this 10 years doing this. And one of the things you decided to do was to write about the pickup artist game.
Yeah.
And that got to be kind of addictive for you. So walk me through that.
Yeah, sure. I'll walk you through that. So that started because my book editor, who I'd done these other books with, called me up and said, hey, I found a secret community of pickup artists online. And they're guys without money, without looks, without fame, who've like cracked the code of seduction and figured out just how to do it with anyone. And me not having money, looks, or fame, and being really always the guy who was in the friend zone, who you'd think it was the big moment, you'd go in for the kiss, and you'd get the cheek turn, and the let's just be friends speech. So I thought, in my head, I thought, there's no way I ever want to write about this, ever.
So that was pushing a big limit for you.
Yeah, but I'm going to pretend like I want to write about it so I can get this information and learn it for myself.
Okay.
And that's kind of how it began. And so I started, I mean, I wish I could say I did it with journalistic objectivity, but I did it with lonely male patheticness.
It's a skill that just about every guy would like to have, depending on how and when they're going to use it.
And right. what was fascinating and is still fascinating about this world is what it was guys all over the world who were, you know, kind of inventing and creating and these techniques for meeting women. It wasn't just for sex. It was for someone's for relationships. Someone's for just esteem, to be liked, whatever their reasons were. I mean, obviously a lot of broken people, but interesting. But it really was like a worldwide lab, but with lab with no variables. And literally some of the things in this community you later read about in scientific studies where people would study and would prove these things out. But it really was like a, it was a lab. So there's no, if something worked for you and then you shared it and it worked for all the thousands of other people all over the world, then you knew, okay, there was something to this.
That would be the scientific method, even though it wasn't double-blinded. It's amazing how you can gather things that work without having a journal involved, right?
And in a way, because there were no variables being controlled, you know, there's a plus to that, and there's also the minus to that. So it was nice that there were that it was in real the real world. And B is it didn't have to work 100% of the time. It had to be proven. It just had to work enough of the time. It was good enough to walk up to someone, know that 9 times out of 10 it's going to work out. That's pretty awesome. Odds.
That's profound. I never went through any kind of training like that.
Right, because you're so married, cool.
Married. No, I've just been married right. for a long time. Right. So like, there's no point to it. But when I was single, if I'd had those skills, I imagine I would have put them to use quite often. I think most guys would, at least not necessarily in a manipulative way. And that was always the criticism and thing that didn't ever seem attractive to me, where you're like, okay, like it's one thing to connect with someone and on an emotional level and all that. It's another thing to like, you know, we're going to just like kind of, I'm going to trick you into bed sort of. So what changed after years of doing this? Yeah, because the truth is a radically different book.
Right. And I'll tell you what changed. And as we're talking, that I remember, I think the moment where I got caught up and like lost in this world was really the first moment I met one of these pickup artists, this guy named Mystery, who's the main character in my book. And we were at a hotel lounge here, and at the time Scott there, we walked in, was almost empty, so I said, hey, let's just go somewhere where I can watch you work and see what it is you do. And there was like two couples there together, four people, and it was Scott Baio, the actor from Happy Days or whatever that he was from, and he was there with this kind of beautiful woman and another couple, and he's like, no, it's okay, I can show you what I do. And he walks up to those four people and literally within 10 minutes got the phone number of Scott Baio's date. And he was a...
In front of Scott Baio?
He was a magician. And Scott Baio turned to me and he goes, is this a magic trick or is he stealing my date? And when I saw that, I thought...
That's unbelievable.
I think anyone who could just walk up to someone of the opposite or same sex and start a conversation was already, in my books, had much more courage than I did or was my hero. And for him to walk up and do that, I was like, okay... And so if you asked about the belief before, what allowed me, I thought if someone else can do it, there's no reason why I can't do it or why I can't learn to do it. So maybe what's allowed me to do that stuff is the belief that, hey, if someone else can do it and there's no physical limitation to it, then I should be able to do it or learn it.
I'm thinking back about a little bit, maybe 11 or so years ago, I got out of a long-term relationship and I was not in real good shape mentally about it. And one of my friends had gotten involved in the pickup artist community, and he was insane, and he was not an attractive guy,
right.
But he was picking up different women every night, and I remember we went out to some bar, and he literally was like, "Here, I'll pick one up for you." I'm like, "That's not possible!" And literally, he like brings a girl over who's like sits on my lap and starts kissing me, and I'm like, "Okay, what planet am I on?" Because that's not really something right. that I would have even conceived of as being possible. And I mean, it was kind of nice, but it was still something that just kind of made me go, like, there's a lot of stuff I don't understand about all this. But my friend, man, he was putting all of his energy into picking up women. Like, he couldn't stop almost.
Yeah, it really became compulsive. And I mean, the negative.
Yeah, what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, the negative side of it is the compulsion, obviously, the manipulation and the objectification are just not spiritually, psychologically healthy things.
It wasn't healthy, and you could see it. And all of his friends, who were also my friends, were like, "He's not on a good path."
Right. And I'll say the positive side about it. Hey, is there something that you want to do in this life? Why not learn to be better at it? Why not learn to understand people better, how people work? So there are positive sides of it as well. And I've seen a lot of people. For example, I was just at a book signing on the new book, and a guy came up, and he was a Syrian refugee, and he lost his entire family.
Wow.
He got to London, knew no one, was almost killed 3 times. He said, somehow I got your book and I read it, and that allowed me to build a new social, you know, peer group and network here.
So being able to connect, especially if you're someone who's been traumatized or just didn't have social skills growing up, which actually I didn't really have social skills growing up. I had like Asperger's symptoms most of the time.
Right.
Having a playbook, it is immensely valuable. And I don't know that I've ever talked about this on the air. The reason I can do a lot of what I do is because for 2 years, every Thursday night, I would show up on Stanford's campus in Silicon Valley. They had this business networking group from like when dot-coms were first emerging. And I would go there as like this fat dork and like just watch how people interacted and like practice.
Right.
And I actually got to be good at business networking and I developed social skills and I learned how to, you know, talk to people and listen to people. But it was actually conscious effort to do that because I really was like a super geek and I wouldn't make eye contact and all that stuff because it wasn't natural to me. And now it is.
And that's exactly what this group was. It wasn't like they made it up. They would backward engineer what was working for people who are naturally successful. So for example, let's say you'd be out there and you're, you know, scrawny like me, scrawny 5'6" guy and some like huge football jock, you're talking to this woman doing your thing, you know, just picks you up and moves you to one side and says, all right, little man, run away. And there's no way, then you think, instead of thinking, oh, I'm really humiliated, that guy's hurt my feelings, you think, okay, what did he do? And then how can I respond to that next time he does it? Then you think, okay, he sort of, then, you know, next time he does it, you go, wow, look at you. Look at those muscles. And, oh, my God, you must, what can you bench press? You're great. You should be like my security guard or something next time we're going out. So you could, like, you can, without starting a fight or anything, you can sort of, like, you can outmaneuver them once you understand what their moves are.
And see, that's control right there. Like, that's about, well, before it had been, I'm out of control. This guy just like punted me basically. Right. And all of a sudden you're like, now I'm in control because you analyzed the situation and you took a conscious decision versus an emotional or just a reactionary kind of thing.
And then the moment he gets like a little bit reactionary, then you look at her and you go, you know what? This guy's kind of creeping me out. Let's get out of here. Right.
Oh, God.
And so bad. And so it was fascinating. So it really was like this lab, but what the good side of it, what it taught me was, I used to think there were, you know, either you had or you didn't. There were people who were cool or people who weren't. And what the community was like, oh, you can actually learn it. I mean, there were guys who were literally just like you at Stanford were writing down long posts on breaking down humor because they didn't have a sense of humor. And they were trying to understand how to have a sense of humor. It gets amazingly, I guess it's social hacking, I suppose.
There's something noble about someone who realizes, look, I have no sense of humor. I have no social skills. I recognize that that's missing. Right. I want that in my life, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to get that. Okay,
right.
That is actually badass. I totally respect that.
Right.
And if you choose to apply that to, you know, basically having sex with different women every single night, maybe I don't respect that because spiritually that will harm you.
Right. And most of those guys did not want to have sex with a different woman every night.
Okay.
They just wanted to be some guys did, by the way, and it's not to defend, it's just to say some people wanted to just be in a relationship with the people they chose to be in a relationship with. Other people wanted to be socially popular. Other people just wanted options. Other people wanted to go out and not be wallflowers. Everyone had their own motivations. And I think a lot of it was about esteem.
And you would imagine that. I know for me, my ability to do that business networking kind of thing, I certainly didn't have really good self-esteem there. Like I knew I was doing some cool stuff with tech, but it was like I wanted to see how these people were successful because I was really success motivated. And I was like, I know there's a game here.
Right.
I don't understand it at all, but I really learned so much from that. And a few people who just knew how to network mentored me. And so I learned how to do that. And that's different than the dating world, but actually business and dating are incredibly similar.
It's also outcome seeking. Got a call from like a national intelligence organization and they give the game to all their field agents.
No way.
And they read the game and they use the exact same process, but the close is different. So I went there to actually train them using the exact same stuff we're talking about.
Wow.
Only the close might be getting someone to turn informant on their boss or getting a scientist to turn over secrets from another state, but it was all the same stuff.
Did you think that would happen?
Never. No, and I've trained charities on how to get, you know, donors and all that stuff, and I never thought it would happen.
So the techniques are the same, but the close is different, basically.
Right, exactly.
So you could do national sales training probably for car salesmen. And
In a second, I think Dan Kennedy, who's a great marketer, said the game was one of the best sales manuals he's
written. Yeah. Okay. So you cracked that code, which is remarkable. But now the truth comes out.
Right.
That's actually funny. I didn't plan that. But, you know, the truth, as in the title of your book, comes out. And after all of this time, spending a good portion of your energy on this, you shifted gears a lot. Walk me through the precipitating event. Like, what made you decide to change?
Sure. It's interesting. Life's so interesting, you know? Yeah. So I think... I think for me, well, it was great. I learned how to meet people, but how do you actually stay in relationships with them?
It's different.
And it wasn't like I really, obviously, it wasn't that I wanted to be, ever wanted to be a pickup artist per se. I just wanted to, I really always, the plan is to get married, have kids, and be a great dad and all that stuff. Yet all my relationships just floundered and failed. And so it came from that. It was really trying to figure out intimacy and connection. And I grew up, both my parents just hate each other, but stayed together, hating each other.
Oh, that's not a good role model situation, yeah. Right?
And my mom would always say, whatever you do, never grow up to make anyone as miserable as your father makes me. So I mean, you can see I have the psychological template to get involved, stuck into that community.
Yeah, that's right? Not a nice thing to say to your kids. Okay.
And so as soon as someone felt unhappy or bad in a relationship, I think, look at me, I'm ruining them. I got to protect them from me. And so I had so many.
And you had some codependence stories going on there for sure. Then,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I just wanted to solve that problem.
I see it now. So first off, like, I want to learn how to meet people, how to meet women, how to initiate relationships. Right. That was one set of skills that you hacked.
Right.
Like, flat out hacked.
Yeah.
And then the second one was, now I'd like to actually be happy with them and stay with them, yeah, which is a very different set of skills. And you decided to hack that.
That's exactly it. And the two inciting incidents were, one is a friend who's watched me the whole time and is kind of a mentor, really say, well, you got everything you wanted with women. Why are you still not happy? And it's great. I mean, the best thing you can get in life is to get everything you want,
yeah,
whether it's money, fame, success, sex, marriage, whatever it is you want, and then realize that it hasn't solved the problems and you have to look inside.
I think there's like an ancient Chinese proverb that I'm probably hacking, and it's like a curse. And it's like, you know, may you get everything you want.
Right. But it's a blessing, because then you can start to realize, because I interview people for Rolling Stone,
mm-hmm,
when I talk to people who achieved the pinnacle, they instantly got depressed. And they got depressed because before, when they were unhappy, they could say, oh, it's because I'm not there yet. Then when they got there and they're still depressed, they're like, oh, okay, maybe it had nothing to do with that.
I tell you, when I was 16, I wrote on the Think and Grow Rich kind of goal on my mirror that was like, I'm going to make $1 million by the time I'm 23. I don't know why that was my goal, but I was convinced that money would just like the key to happiness. It didn't work because I made $6 million when I was 26. But okay, that's still pretty badass.
Right.
I never said make and keep, because I lost $6 million when I was 28. So like, I briefly had it.
Be careful what you wish for.
But here's the thing. When I had $6 million, you know what was going to make me happy? $10 million. Like, how dumb could I have been, right?
Right?
Like, but I got there and it didn't change my life. It didn't make me more happy. I mean, my car was faster, but like, that was it.
Yeah.
My relationships still sucked. Like I still had all the self-esteem things and all the other stuff I was working on. And so I'm seeing you had the same pattern here.
Yeah,
but it was relationship based. Okay, I got it, and it wasn't what I wanted, or it wasn't what you thought you wanted.
And it even could be, and it could be the dating game thing, that I think if you're looking for something outside yourself to make yourself okay, that just becomes a drug fix, whether it is.
It's a dopamine thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so what happened, and the inciting event, as much as I hate to say it, but it's true and it's in the book, is cheated on my girlfriend and then felt horrible. I felt, how could I have done this to somebody who I care about? How could I have hurt this? How could I have ruined my chances for my future? And as someone, how could I break my own moral, ethical code just for sex that wasn't even that good anyway? And then I really, and the book begins with me checking into sex addiction rehab, which is a fascinating, which was a ironic place to be. Half the guys there had read the game.
Sorry,
guys. yeah, one guy was like, you really, the fact that I was in there was crushing him. and it was fascinating. And that's where the journey began, because the great thing about addiction psychology is it has to work, because lives are at stake.
Yeah.
And it was really the turnaround moment was not the, and I'm not talking about the 12-step stuff, I'm talking about the core childhood issues that are the software in which you're operating today. That regular therapy, you sit in a room with someone for $150 or $250 a week with no treatment plan, just talking to them, I'm really skeptical of it.
And, I am too.
If you're an addict, that's not going to work. What they really have to do is save your life, because that next drink is going to burst an esophageal vein, or the next shot of heroin is going to be a hot one, and you're done. So lives are at stake, and they just have to do what works. And so that's the moment my life was changed. And by the way, not because of rehab, because I started. I thought I was the normal person writing about the crazy people. You know, I did a book with Marilyn Manson, with Motley Crue, all the journalism stuff, even the pickup artists. I was kind of the quote unquote normal one in that book, looking at the crazy pickup artists. And this was the first time when I realized that I was just as crazy as them. And so is everybody. We just don't know it because we're living with ourselves and we're so close to ourselves. We can't see it. It seems normal because that's how we've been habituated.
There's something you described in there that sounded really familiar to me. You talk about how, like, how could I have done this? You know, I cheated on my girlfriend and it went against my beliefs. That as a 300-pound obese person, I'd sit there and I'd look at the crumbs from the donut and exactly the same mindset. Right. Like, I said I wasn't going to do that. Right? I decided not to do it. I set an intent not to do that. And then an urge happened, and it was one that I couldn't deny. Mostly it's because you ran out of willpower, because that same urge happened 1,000 times and I did deny it while I was looking at the thing, because, you know, my body was like, eat it. And I'm like, no, eat it, no. But sex is kind of the same way, right? You saw whoever you cheated with and you're like, she's really hot. Like, I'd like some of that. And then you're like, I'm not going to do it. But at some point you gave in. Was right. It actually, did you run out of willpower when you did that?
I can see that being it. I think that's one way to think about it, because I love that it's a great book, that willpower book, and the idea that it's this limited resource. It's really influenced some of the things I do in my life. I try to automate as many decisions that are unnecessary as I can to conserve that.
I think you and me both. Like, yeah, I live, like, don't make me decide.
Yeah, exactly. Like all the, but so all my lunches are, you know, pre-ordered from each of my favorite places each day of the week. You do that too?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Anytime I can not have to decide what's on my plate, it's a free decision.
Exactly. So what I think it is, the things to recognize about yourself are, if you say you're not going to do something and you do it, because let's just face it, if you keep losing that willpower every day, it's not that you just ran out of willpower that day. There's something more compulsive taking a hold of you. So anytime you make the decision, I'm going to start doing this or stop doing that, and you can't do it, and maybe you said it a couple times, then it's not a behavioral problem. It's a deeper problem.
It's like an emotional thing.
Right. So I would say if there's a difference between the game and the truth, it's not just one's about dating, the other one's about, or one's about courtship, one's about relationships. It's really, the game is about behaviors. Hey, if I talk to this person and I tilt my body to this little angle and say these words, I'm going to have a better response. And it's easy to change those things, but the truth and the stuff in relationships is really about your beliefs, and they're much harder to recognize, let alone change.
One of the biggest learnings of my own path has been that it's not enough to sit somewhere and act the right way, because at some base level, the people you're around know that you're just acting.
Right.
You need to actually be that way.
Exactly.
Like you've got to do it like here in your heart or in your body, viscerally, as well as behave in the right way. And if you feel it viscerally and you behave in the wrong way, then you probably should read the game.
Right.
But a lot of people who are reading the game weren't feeling it or acting it. And so they started acting it, but they didn't learn how to feel it.
And
am I getting this right? I mean, this is my perception of it, just because I struggled with relationships and all this kind of stuff as well. I mean, am I putting words in your mouth?
You know, I'm just thinking of your interpretation of it. I'm just seeing it as your interpretation of it being a valid interpretation. I think we call it congruence. You want to be congruent. What's on the outside has to match on the inside, and people pick up on that instantly. So a lot of the game guys are like these fake alpha males, and they'll learn to sit with like their legs spread out really wide, because alpha males do that, and they'll walk like they're walking around a massive package with their arms swinging, like they're around moving around large pecs, you know, and like you see that person, you just think they're incongruent. They're faking something that they're not, versus a person who actually, you know, naturally is like that, and you think, oh, that guy must be a wrestler or something.
Right.
Right. Or where your other one is, you think that must be a guy with a, you know, problems.
Okay. Right. I totally hear you.
Yeah. So it's congruence. And I think you work toward congruence. But if you're going to change a behavior, there's probably a middle period where you are incongruent. And at the end of it, you want to be back in alignment. But let's talk about the belief stuff, because I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And I think that the big lesson for me was that the big issue in relationships has nothing. I always thought it had something to do with the other person. You know, there's something was wrong with, they were like this, they were like that. Why can't they be more like this?
Yeah.
Or something was wrong with their relationship. And what I realized amongst thousands of other lessons, but is that it was only about me and only about the way I was relating to them. It had nothing whatsoever to do with them.
Yeah.
And it was amazing that by changing the way I thought and perceived someone, that they became a whole new person and love and intimacy were possible.
What was the most important thing for teaching you how to change how you thought or felt about an, or perceived another person?
Beliefs are incredible. I'd love to go deeper into it and how they form and how we can see them and how they can really destroy our lives.
Yeah.
Because I always think, why do people self-sabotage? Why they have these goals? Why don't they reach them? And it all has to do with their with their beliefs.
It's the software, right?
Right. It's the software. And a lot of the truth is really about running a virus scan on yourself and seeing where the bugs in your software are.
Really. Great analogy.
Yeah. And how is this stuff programmed in? And some people have real problems doing it. I'll explain why that is. But wait, what was the question I was about to answer? So
it was like, what was the most important thing to understand about changing that stuff?
The most important, here's the craziest, most annoying thing. That when you recognize what the belief is, it's still not enough to change it.
Yeah, that's true.
There's so much habit. And so, for example, someone I work with is an overeater, and he always goes on the diets, and they're very successful diets, but they don't last, right?
Yeah.
And because it has nothing to do with what he's eating, it's that, in his case, as a child, his mom wasn't very affectionate, but she'd show her love by cooking for him. So when he's feeling bad, he goes and eats his food and gets his love. Right. So that has to be rewired. Even if you recognize that's why, you're still going to do it. And you have to, they're a bunch of amazing, and you have to sort of treat this issue almost like a psychological cancer in a sense.
Yeah.
And really attack it with the whatever tools are going to go the deepest. And
what are the tools you like for attacking? Sure. I'm sure everyone listening knows they have a weakness around something like that or an area they'd like to improve.
Not everybody. So there are two kinds of people.
Interesting.
Right? There are people who think something is wrong with them.
Okay.
And then there are people who think something is wrong with everybody else because they're perfect.
Why is everyone so stupid? Right.
And I was going to write a book or like a Kindle single called The Power of Low Self-Esteem.
Yeah.
Because like we were talking earlier, the fact that you felt deficient or something was wrong with you and the fact that I did allowed us to grow and improve.
Yeah.
But there are certain people who just think they're great, something's wrong with someone else, and they can't look at themselves and they have defensive grandiosity.
Narcissists, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Someone said the other day, narcissism is a reflection of an emptiness inside.
Yeah.
So they're really the ones to feel sorry for, you know, if they need to do like de-affirmations in the mirror, you know, I suck.
you suck.
Yeah, I'm not so good. So here are the things. So I really think the therapy model is broken.
Yeah.
And because a lot of the stuff didn't come in intellectually. You know, came in through feelings and through experiences.
It's not intellectual. Right? Feelings are not intellectual. They can't be because they're not thoughts, right?
Right. So by talking it through, it doesn't do much. And so how I think the model should work, and this is kind of what I did, is I wish the other problem is, A, health insurance doesn't cover this. It's just go somewhere and get the medication to cover up the symptoms. Mm-hmm. You know, one visit and a prescription. So one of the problems is like, psychological, emotional healing is a rich person's game in the sense that it's not cheap.
Yeah.
So just with that caveat. And the second caveat is what's really blowing my mind, if I kind of have a mission now, it's that, you know, if we're sick, we do something for our physical health and go to hospital. If we're for our intellectual health, we have to go to school. But we don't do anything as a culture for our emotional health or learning what's emotionally healthy. And many of the things that people think are emotionally healthy are really not. And we can discuss that later. But we only do that later in life if something's really seriously debilitating wrong that's hurting us or others. And then there's so much shame around it. And so I think learning emotional health would be important for our culture.
Just even being aware of shame.
Yeah. Right?
Like a lot of people have shame and they don't know they have shame because it's always been there. It's like being colorblind or something. You wouldn't know you were colorblind because you've always been colorblind, right?
Yeah. And why did I just get angry now? At someone that actually had nothing to do with them, I felt a certain way that it was a learned response from childhood.
What you're saying rings true to me. My path was pretty different in that I basically hooked a lie detector up to my head.
Right.
And realized there was a huge disparity between the emotions and the thoughts and managed to get them aligned that way.
Yeah.
Where I'd tell myself something that was not true. And well, the computer showing me that it's not true. And you're like, damn it. Like, how did I get that belief?
Right.
And then a lot of transpersonal psychology, which is all feeling based instead of talking based.
Yeah.
Without that, I probably would have no idea what emotions I was having right now because I don't think I naturally knew.
Yeah. It's so funny. We get so mad at other people if they say something to us, but the way we talk to ourselves is like unconscionable. The things we say to ourselves, if someone said it to us, we would hate them for the rest of our lives.
Like if the voice in your head was a friend, you'd fire them as a friend in a minute.
Yeah, I'm really into, and by the way, when I close that loop on what I think therapy should be, but I'm really into the stories we tell ourselves that and then that we keep proving are right and become more reinforced and getting out of that box.
Yeah.
So, but how, if in my ideal sort of model, how it would work is you'd have a primary care, say psychologist or therapist, who would say, okay, here's your core issue. Your core issue is, you had a very critical parent or a parent who won't say, and we would need to work on the esteem issues around that. Or they would just choose one. Or they'd say you had a parent who wasn't there, and thus you have feelings of worthlessness and not being valued and worried your partner isn't going to leave you. Or you had a parent who only judged you by your results, by your grades. I think you were talking about achievers. So you're by your touchdowns or by your grades. And then thus you think you need to achieve to get love. And then you get those people who say, like you just said, 1 million wasn't enough. I needed 10 million or what have you.
Right.
Or 6 million wasn't enough.
That's like the Buddhist hungry ghost idea. Like no matter what you eat, you're always hungry.
Yeah.
And not eat just like food wise, but just like no matter what you consume or what you do or what you have, there's always more.
Right.
And that like so, that's that belief you're talking about.
Right. So they say, hey, this is the problem. This is the core issue. Now let's develop a treatment plan for it. That treatment plan might be, okay, you're going to go to, there are all these great week long programs that really, or weekend or 3 or 4 day programs where you really get to the emotional root of it and purge it almost like an exorcism of those.
I did like a 10-day one of those early on in my own.
What was process. That?
It was called the Star Foundation.
Uh-huh.
And it was a nonprofit thing, deeply transpersonal, holotropic breath work. And, and like even I realized I had PTSD around my birth. I had the cord wrapped around my neck, which affects the way you see the world. And the world's a threatening place all the time.
You're in paradise and right away. It's like you're in hell.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, all those things play an effect. And it's amazing when my son was born at the hospital, I'm like, okay, you're caring for his physical health, but not his psychological health.
And they abuse babies.
It really is. It's like his first experience is getting poked and prodded for no reason. They put him in, you know, NICU and gave him a spinal tap. I'm like, no, even as an adult, you would hate that. It's breaking my heart. And I'm like, wow, I got to start the healing right now.
You're right. And it's a gift that you were able to do that. Because imagine if you didn't have the knowledge you have and that happened to your baby. Then you're like, I don't know why.
Thank God they're taking care of my baby. They're saving him.
Right. Yeah. And even whether those are necessary or not, there is an emotional healing that happens anytime a human's traumatized, as an adult who has surgery or as a baby. But no one ever taught me this stuff. I'm like from a family of hardcore like nuclear scientist people.
Right.
So for me to realize, like, okay, like this lady at the Star Foundation, she's got my number because she looked at me, she asked me one question about my birth and was able to like diagram my personality. Right. And I was like, she knows like all my weaknesses and all the things I'm ashamed of. And like, oh,
it was
weird. Right.
And here's my attitude when I go in, there's so many things. So say your primary care therapist says, okay, you need to go to the Star Foundation. Then you need some somatic experiencing. Have you done that? Somatic experiencing deals with trauma trapped in the body.
Oh, okay. We didn't call it that, but that was most of what they
It's great
do.
Stuff. This guy, Peter Levine, developed it. And it's almost like the way in a movie, a ghost will haunt a house till like his murderer or her murderer has been caught.
Mm-hmm.
This is like the trauma that's floating in your body waiting to be kind of released and let go of. Because as a child, if something that you can't really escape, it all traps in there. So maybe they do that. Maybe they do EMDR, which deals with eye movements in left and right hemispheres.
Profound for people listening right now. If you have stuff that you know, especially is the trauma, EMDR can detune that. I've done EMDR only twice because I'm pretty clean slate right now.
Right.
But there was one thing I was stuck on where I just couldn't forgive this thing. It was really, really hard for me to do this. And I have a forgiveness practice. And I'm like, you know what? I'm thinking way too much about things. And I know the behaviors about another person. It's in the public sphere. I'm like, I'm done. So I did EMDR one time. And literally, I'm like, oh, the reason this is triggering this, and I know I've never said this on the radio, something that happened to me in first grade. set up this dynamic that I was unaware of. As a thinking, aware person, the dynamic was that I would be accused of something that I didn't do and then have to take the fall for it. Like, right. Some kid said I did something I didn't do, right? But right. At the time, it traumatized me.
Yeah.
And so I was feeling all these weird emotions as an adult because I was accused of stuff that I didn't do. And once I figured out what that was, we did EMDR one time where they move your eyes back and forth, and all of a sudden, it was gone. It's like the voice in my head that I didn't know how to right. shut up, gone.
And that was your story, like we were saying earlier. Yeah. This is my thought on EMDR, and Francine Shapiro, who I've talked to, who created it, might not agree with how it works, but it's how I think of it, is what you do with EMDR is they'll wag this little pointer left while you think about the trauma and go back there.
Yeah.
And your eyes move left and right. Then they'll put tones in your ear that go left to right, and then they'll tap your left and right knee. And what I think about it is a trauma, like as a, I think of it, it's sort of like a concentrated, it sort of gets concentrated in an area of your brain.
Yeah.
And by why you thinking about it, by going from left to right hemisphere, it just sort of takes a, maybe a stain or a spread and spreads it out so you can't see it as much.
Great
and that's
analogy.
The way I think about it. And what I wanted to say is for some people listening, people might go online and look up in the stuff and I'll say, oh, this is it proven? Is it disproven? I don't actually care because none of it is going to hurt. So it doesn't hurt right. to just try it and what works for and just see what works for you. So my attitude is I thought of it like this: trauma, and everybody has trauma, and we can get into why that is in a second, but everybody has trauma. I think of it almost like a you know, a cancerous, you know, ball attached to your heart by an elastic band. And when you do something, say EMDR, it stretches that band a little bit, but then maybe you leave and you feel like it's cured, and then something else happens and you dwell on being accused of this stuff, and bam, it snaps back. And if you keep stretching mm-hmm. the elastic with EMDR, then somatic experiencing, some of these deep, you know, kind of gestalt-like chair work is great, all these different things, and you keep stretching, and eventually it loses its resiliency and doesn't hang on so tight. It's like the half-life of radioactive material. You can maybe never get rid of it entirely, but you keep cutting it in half and in half and in half, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller till you meet that beautiful woman and you're in a relationship, and you're like, yeah, she's beautiful, but I don't have to go, you know, do the game. Or you right. see that cake and you don't have to eat it. Or you see that money opportunity that's going to take you away from your family and your friends and your happiness, and you don't have to take it.
That's pretty profound stuff. And the fact that you're so, actually in all of your books, you're really raw. Even Emergency, you're talking about what's going on, you know, the fear you have, and then to talk about it in the game. And then now to sum it up with the truth. It's a remarkable path you've been through, and I think it's incredible that you're willing to go out there and talk about stuff that a lot of guys wouldn't, about EMDR and trauma and birth and all that weird stuff that programs us. Right. Like that's where all that crap comes right. from that kept you from being in a good relationship, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing I wanted to say for the 35% of listeners who are listening and thinking, you know, hey, this stuff isn't for me or what have you, is that we're born, and this is the way this is why human beings have taken over the entire planet. We're born to be adaptable. We're born, and the reason we're born so early, and like, I had goats when I was doing Emergency, and as soon as I delivered the goats, they're up on their feet running around instantly, right?
Right.
And when we're born, it takes a couple of years before we even have decent language skills and a good year till we can walk a little bit. And the reason we're born so early is so we can adapt to our environment, and that's why we've done such a good job of colonizing this planet, possibly the universe soon, right?
Right.
And so if you think of your brain, it's all a lot of the neurons are there, but the architecture isn't there, and that architecture is developed in those first years. I think it's something, they're all kinds of figures, something like 2 million new neural connections a second a child is mm-hmm. making. So at the age of three, do you know this? At the age of three, you have twice as many neural connections as an adult.
Yeah, and they get pruned.
And then they get pruned
older,
and gone
right.
away. So what's that shaped by? It's what are your experiences? What is love like? What is your relationship like? When you cry and you're hungry, you're being fed, are you not being fed? Are you being ignored? Are you safe? Are you not safe? All these things are creating that, and then when they're pruned away, right, and it's reduced in half, that then becomes the box you live in, and that's reality. That's your reality. And that's when you see something, you're like, how can someone do that? How can someone think that? Why are people voting for, you know, why are people supporting Trump or something? They were just born with different boxes, you know? It makes no sense. I can't even understand why somebody would support Trump after the things he's saying. But But when I do the, and then when I do these articles and I talk to these people, I can start to understand, okay, they were raised in a way where anything outside or different or foreign is dangerous to them and a threat, and that's their false reality they're living in.
Well, it's really helpful, and this is something I didn't understand, is that I always thought other people were either crazy or stupid because they weren't like me.
Right.
Right. And just like you said, like their neural pruning was very different than mine, and like different people's are different than each other's too. And just being willing to accept that and realize that almost everything that I thought was about me was actually about them. Like that's just having that knowledge for me was relaxing.
So here's my question for you.
Okay.
You said control earlier, and control's, you know, the issue. And I know kind of your origin story about why you do what you do. But what do you think, because again, a lot of biohacking, social engineering, all this stuff is a lot about control.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think in your family of origin model, the reason is why you need control to feel safe?
For me, it's not about feeling safe anymore, although it certainly was. I never felt safe at all. I was bullied, and I've been in like 100 fist fights and stuff. And plus just coming into the world, being choked by an umbilical cord will make you feel unsafe constantly and chronically, right, in the background. I think I'm done with that. So for me, though, my brain was going away in my mid-20s. I couldn't think. I couldn't pay attention when I was really interested in something like this conversation. There were many times in my life where I'd be looking at you and I'd be like, my eyes would be closing and I'd be kind of drooling on myself. I'd be like, I really want to do this, but I can't. And the can't isn't a word I use lightly. I can't because my freaking brain won't work. So for me, it was like my body is betraying me. My knees hurt all the time. My feet are flat. Walking hurts all the time. And I... Like that's not okay. So for me, having a weak biological start meant that if I'm going to do the things I want to do, having control of that means that my meat will support my brain.
And
that's what makes me do it.
And I would argue, and I know we have to end in a second because the desperate housewives are outside waiting to get into our studio.
They can wait.
We gotta do it. I thought they'd be late. But
I did too.
So maybe we'll talk about this off air.
Sure.
But here's my thought. Uh-huh. My belief is, so other people would be like that and just sort of maybe accept it or let go, or there's nothing I can do. But I think something in you said, I'm not going to be a victim of this. I'm not going to, I have control over this. And maybe there's something in your childhood where maybe your needs weren't taken care of in the same way and you learned that you could be self-sufficient and take control.
I'll explore that. I don't know what precipitating thing that would be, but it's a very valid question.
5 minutes after we'll
discuss. Okay, we'll talk after this. Okay. I'm dying to know what you have to say. And there's one more question I'm going to ask you before the Desperate Housewives come in and wrestle us to the floor. And that is the final question for all the interviews. Three things. If someone came to you tomorrow and said, I want to kick ass at everything, what are the three most important things to know?
Humility. Number one thing you do, if you're not kicking ass and you've been doing your best, then you've done your best with your current brain.
Yeah.
So you need to accept that maybe you know nothing. B, mentorship. Finding anyone who's better than you. It doesn't have to be Dave. It could literally be just anyone who's a little bit better than you. And third one, and I just learned this lesson recently from watching my 9-month-old, is when he's trying to roll over or sit up or walk or learning these skills, he can do it all day because he'll practice all day. It's only the very few times when he tries to do it that he fails. So, or that he gets frustrated. And there's no failure when you're practicing. There's only failure when you're trying. So the third thing would be practice instead of try.
Ooh, love that one. Very profound. Neil, it's always a pleasure. It's been an honor to have you on the show. Your new book, The Truth, absolutely is worth reading for a whole variety of reasons outside of relationships. But you've developed a really interesting sense of just self-awareness. And I mean, kudos to you for the courage to just put it out there in print. Where can people find you and where can they find your book?
The book, hopefully, you know, anywhere, right. and neilstrauss.com. I don't say .com anyway. Just Google my friggin' name. But yeah. It's the website. And I do like have a mailing list where I really don't market stuff. I just write down great ideas that I share occasionally that I think are good.
Awesome. If you enjoyed today's show, there's something special you can do because, well, the Bulletproof the Cookbook just came out. So go to Amazon and buy The Truth and buy Bulletproof the Cookbook at the same time, and then they'll be like bonded together. So this time every time someone wants to buy the cookbook, they'll see Neil's book. Every time they see Neil's book, they'll see the cookbook, and then we both win, and that would be awesome.
You can be healthy physically and psychologically.
Yeah, like they go well together, right? Neil, thanks again.
Thanks. That was great.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.